One more, and then, yeah, the very last exam. Okay. Yeah, so I tell you what, this is Bio 241. It's Tuesday, November 4th, the day after your last test, and you got two more tests in here. I don't know how many more quizzes you have. Probably have about four or five quizzes left maybe in lab, something like that. So one more test, and then the final test, but the final test is just a regular test. It's not cumulative over whatever we cover from the fourth test. All right, well, we were talking about the sensory system, and we're almost done with the senses chapter. We're in the middle of vision, and we were talking about accommodation. So can you tell me in your own words what accommodation means? What the adaptation to what? When you look at something at different distances from your eyes, yeah. So it's not adaptation to light, per se, but for distance, right? So you have to accommodate, for instance, if you're going to read something or if you're going to look far away, you have to change your distance of focus, and we call that accommodation. So what structures are important for accommodation in the eye? Okay, for accommodation in the eye, the structures. The ciliary body, yeah, and you could call the ciliary body the ciliary muscle if you want. Right, so that muscle, what is a muscle specialized to do? To contract, right? So to contract or relax. So that ciliary body is right here. And on this slide, it's actually labeled the ciliary muscle. That's fine with me. You could call it ciliary muscle. And there are some ligaments that are attached to the ciliary muscle. And I tell you what, let's look at the structure of that ciliary muscle. What does it look like? A nice rectus muscle or deltoid, or how would you characterize the shape of this muscle right here? It's circular. It's like an orbicularis, right? But it's really a smooth muscle, so it's not we don't call it orbicularis because those are reserved for skeletal muscle. But it's more like a sphincter. It's a circular smooth muscle. And when that smooth muscle contracts, the circle constricts. And when that muscle relaxes, right, the circle gets bigger because muscle has elastic properties. Okay, so when it contracts, it gets smaller. So think of the tension that's going to be applied on these ligaments. Right, on the other end of the ligament is the lens. Now the lens is supposed to change shape, right? And as we pull the lens, it gets thinner. And as we relax the tension on these suspensory ligaments right here, the lens gets thicker, and that changes your point of focus in front of your eyes. Okay, so how does that tension change when this muscle contracts? So as the muscle contracts, all right, what happens to the tension on those suspensory ligaments? Because when the muscle contracts, what happens to it? It gets bigger or smaller? It gets smaller. So if it gets smaller, what happens to the tensions on those ligaments? The lens isn't changing the diameter very much. All right, so what happens as that ciliary muscle gets smaller and smaller and smaller? What happens to the tension on those suspensory ligaments? Maybe another way of thinking about it is the opposite. What happens if that circle gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger? What happens to the tension on those ligaments? Yeah, then they actually start to stretch, right? And the tension increases as the muscle relaxes. So it's kind of the opposite way that you normally think about how tension is applied to a tendon or a ligament. Usually, if you have a tendon and the muscle contracts, what is it doing? Is it pulling on the tendon or relaxing? So for instance, if I think of the tendon of my biceps brachii, the supraglenoid tubercle, right, and that muscle contracts, what happens to the tension up there? Does it increase or decrease? It increases, right? It increases. So that's usually how we think. But in this particular case, with the ciliary body, as the muscle relaxes, that's when the tension increases. All right, so the ability to keep the eyes focused on the retina as the distance between the eyes and the object varies, right, then the tension, or the state of contraction of that ciliary muscle has to increase. So for instance, on the next slide, distance is over 20 feet, the ciliary body relaxes, and when it relaxes, it gets bigger, and that's when tension is applied to those suspensory ligaments, and that's when the lens flattens out. So the lens should be relatively thin right here and flat, that means that it doesn't add a lot of focusing power to the eye. But as the distance decreases, the ciliary muscles contract. All right, and when they contract, this circle here gets smaller and smaller and smaller. That releases the tension on the suspensory ligaments. And as the tension decreases, then the lens goes back to its normal smaller shape that has a lot of curvature. And you can see what this is, not quite so flat as it was in this first case up over here. So the lens becomes more convex and you're able to focus on things closer and closer to your eyes. All right, so it's the opposite way that you really think how a muscle works when it's applying tension to a tendon. Okay, and we call that accommodation. All right, now what two structures in the eye allow you to focus light rays on the retina? So in order for you to see something clearly, the object has to be focused clearly on the retina, which is about in this location right over here. So we use lenses to focus light. So if you ever take a picture of something and the lens is not in focus, what does that picture look like? Yeah, it's blurry, right? And if the focusing apparatus in a person's eye isn't focusing light on the retina per se, maybe it's focusing in front of the retina or behind the retina, then that image is going to look blurry. All right, so what couple structures in the eye bend light so that it focuses right on the retina? Okay, so you see the lens for sure. You see the curvature on the lens here and here. Right, so that is going to bend light and focus it on the retina. But do you see any other structures on the eye that have curvature that light has to go through? Yeah, you said the cornea. Look at the cornea right here. Look at the curvature of the cornea. The cornea itself actually looks like a lens, doesn't it? Doesn't it kind of look like this anterior surface of the lens right here? And as a matter of fact, if you look at the curvature of the cornea, you see that it's more curved than the lens is. And so the cornea is even more important for focusing light on the retina than the lens is. All right, so there are two structures. In order for you to see things sharply, there are two structures in the eye that work together to focus light. The first one is the lens, and the second one, and actually the more important one, is the curvature or the shape of the cornea. The cornea itself actually acts like a lens. And we're going to see how that works in just a second. All right, so visual acuity is just your sharpness of vision. And that just depends on the resolving power, and that is equal to what your visual discrimination is. How closely can two objects be placed together before they merge into one object? Okay, so it means the ability to resolve two closely spaced dots, maybe on a piece of paper. All right, with myopia, the image is focused in front of the retina. So let's take a look. Well, I tell you what, let's look at a normal case first. So here is a normal eye, right? And this is what we call emmetropia, because look at the light rays coming in. They get bent by the cornea. They get bent by the lens. And where do they focus? Right smack on the retina. So it's a nice sharp image. So no correction is necessary because the light is focusing on the retina. Okay. But for instance, for nearsightedness or myopia, the eyeball is too long compared to the shape of the lens and the cornea. And so the image is actually focusing before it gets to the retina. And now the light rays are diverging already by the time they get to the retina, and the image is blurry. And so what we can do for that condition is put in a concave lens that spreads the light waves out a little bit. So now when they enter the eye, they have to travel further before they're focused, and they focus right on the retina right here. So this is what we call nearsightedness. All right, the other condition is what we call hyperopia, farsightedness. In this condition, a person's eye is way too short, and the light rays come in and get bent. They don't focus on the retina, they focus behind the retina. But you don't have any photoreceptor cells behind the retina. Your photoreceptor cells are here on the retina, and that image is going to look blurry. But it can be easily corrected by putting a convex lens in front of the eye. And that spreads the light rays out, so now they focus right on the retina. All right, so that's the job of the optometrist or ophthalmologist to figure out what shapes these lenses are, and actually with a lot of your help, because they always ask you what? Is this better? Or is this better? Is this one better or this one better? So it's kind of trial and error. That's the cheapest way of doing it. Okay. Well, instead of putting a lens in front of the eye, someone has figured out that we can actually change the curvature of some of these optical components of your eye so that you don't have to wear glasses. And guess what that's called? That's called the LASIK procedure. And the LASIK procedure is pretty neat because what's done is that a physician measures how far away your retina is from your lens or your cornea, right, and the shape of the retina right here. And then it computes what the shape of the cornea has to be so that light focuses on the shape of the retina that you have way in the back of your eye. And then a little surface of epithelium is cut away from the cornea, and that reveals some inner parts of the cornea, and then a laser blasts away a couple layers of cells in the cornea. The cornea changes shape, so now it matches up more perfectly with the retina. The little flap of epithelium over the cornea is replaced, and people have near perfect vision, maybe even better than normal vision as a result of that. So it's kind of a nice procedure because you are surgerizing the eye, but what part of the eye? Do you have to dig around deep inside the eye to get at it? No, the nice thing is that it's right on the surface, okay? But still, even though it's right on the surface, easy to get to, I don't necessarily recommend it for cosmetic reasons because things can go wrong, and that's one part of your body you probably don't want anything to go wrong with, all right? And there probably are some other reasons, too, that the physician doing that procedure would tell you about, and that is as you get older and older and older and older, okay, your vision might change. Sometimes your vision gets better as you get older, but now you've corrected your vision for when you were younger, and so what do you need as you get older? You might need glasses to change it back so that you can see, even though if you hadn't surgerized your eye, you wouldn't need glasses. So I know people that get older and they don't need to wear glasses as they get older. Because why? It's just the shape of the eye that's changing because our body changes as we get older. So LASIK can only change how you focus at one point in your life. It won't last you for your whole lifetime. So that could be one reason. Another reason is, as you get older and older and older, okay, like if you have maybe your parents or grandparents, or if they sat down to read a newspaper or something, what do they need with them? Even if they have good far vision, what do they need to see a newspaper? They need reading glasses, right? Okay, so there is an interplay between your far vision and your near vision. And for instance, you're going to be in a middle age sometime, and you'll notice that if you wear glasses so that you can see far away, sooner or later, in order to read, you're going to have to take those glasses off. If you take them off, you have really good near vision, but if you put your far away glasses on, that destroys your near vision. Okay, that's just because of the optics of the eye. And when people get a LASIK procedure, right, their vision is optimized to see far away, but what does that do to their near vision? Right? It destroys their near vision to where now they can see far away, but what do they have to do to read? They need reading glasses at a much earlier age. So sometimes physicians don't tell people that, and that's really a shame because I've known people to be really excited after a LASIK procedure because they'll go outside and they'll see a beautifully clear world, and then they'll get a call on their cell phone and get their cell phone out of their pocket, and guess what? They don't know how to use their cell phone now because they can't see it. So that's a real bummer. All right, so as you get older, as you perfect your far vision, you decrease the acuity of your near vision, your reading ability. All right, so it's just kind of a trade-off. And the other reason why, I guess I don't recommend it for cosmetic reasons, if you wear glasses, you know, typically I think that's a really excellent thing because the cornea right here, do I have a picture of a cornea, of the light of an eyeball someplace? I think in your book you do. I guess this is good. What can you tell me about this compartment right here? What is in this compartment in front of the eye? Sometimes we call this the anterior chamber of the eye, right? And here is the anterior cavity. Here's the posterior cavity right behind the iris. What kind of fluid is in this compartment compared to this posterior chamber over here? So you got vitreous humor in the posterior chamber, but the anterior chamber you have aqueous humor, right? Okay, and aqueous humor just means that it's water, right? Okay, so the cornea is also loaded with very fine nerve fibers, free nerve endings for pain reception. And if the cornea is damaged, supposedly that will give you the most exquisite sense of pain that you can ever experience. Right, just a very acute, searing, burning pain on your eye. And that's one reason, okay, to wear glasses, just to protect your eye. But the cornea is also very delicate and thin, and it's very easy to perforate the cornea. And when the cornea is perforated, guess what happens to that aqueous humor? If you put a drop of water on the wall or something and let it go, what's going to happen? It's going to just run right down the wall, right? There's nothing holding it in place. So when the cornea gets perforated, that aqueous humor just dribbles right out of the eye. And now there's nothing separating the iris here from this posterior layer of the cornea and the lens. What can you tell me? And so now all those layers are going to touch each other, right? And no one has ever figured out a way how to unstick these structures once they touch each other. They get glued together in there just because of the nature of the lens and the iris and the cornea. All right, so what is this lens supposed to do day in and day out as you use your eyes? Is it just a stationary lens right there, or what's happening to it? It's moving around all the time, right? It's getting thicker and thinner, so it's designed to move so that you can see things far away or up close. We call that what? Accommodation. But the iris, what's the job of the iris? Is it just stationary in your eye, or is it changing all the time? It's changing all the time, too. It's getting bigger and smaller. But I tell you what, if the iris is glued to the cornea and the iris is glued to the lens over here, now can the iris move and can the lens move? No. So now you've lost a lot of function in that eye. And just because that aqueous humor has kind of dribbled out, you have severe vision deficits for the rest of your life. And you might have an eye that's really not useful for much of anything. Okay, you might be able to see light and dark and shadows and things like that, but not reading and things. So, especially for guys or people that ride motorcycles or whatever, I think it's always a good idea to wear eye protection. All right, or if you're doing anything mechanical around the house, like building a swing set for your kids or something where a nut or a bolt can break off and fly in your eye, all right, that could wreck your vision for the rest of your life. So wearing glasses is an excellent thing. So even if you have a LASIK procedure done, whenever you do anything mechanical or working with equipment, wear glasses. Even though maybe they don't do anything for your vision, they just provide a mechanical barrier to protect your eyes. And then that will also spare you from experiencing that exquisite sense of pain when the cornea gets damaged like that. Okay, so those. But if your vision is so poor that you can't even find your glasses in the morning, right, then LASIK is going to do what? It's going to change your life, right? It's just a beautiful kind of procedure to have. Or if you're a professional athlete and you're a boxer, can you go in the boxing ring with glasses? No. And you're going to get paid millions of dollars to do that? Then for sure I get the LASIK procedure and earn a couple million dollars in an evening. Okay, but not just kind of spur of the moment. All right, well, let's talk about the retina. Okay, it has many different layers of cells. So let's just review some of the overall layers of the cell. The outermost layer, this is the tough layer, connective tissue. This is the white of the eye. We call this the sclera. All right, and so that's mostly connective tissue, very, very tough. The next layer is the vascular layer. This is the choroid. And this is the layer that nourishes the lens. You shouldn't have any blood, nourishes the retina. You shouldn't have any blood vessels in the retina, because if you have blood vessels, it's going to push away the photoreceptor cells. And in order for you to sense light, you have to have photoreceptor cells in the retina. So blood vessels only in the choroid layer. And then the retina, which is the deepest layer. We see a little pigmented epithelium right here. We'll talk about the function of that. Then you have rod cells and cone cells. These are the photoreceptor cells. And then you have a bunch of neurons that process information from that they get from the rods and cone cells. Okay, we see some bipolar cells. I think I pointed bipolar cells out to you, where we have bipolar cells only in special sense organs in our body. We have some amacrine cells. And then here are the ganglion cells that have the long axons that go all the way into the central nervous system, okay, through the optic chiasma into the thalamus. And then sometimes they synapse in the thalamus and then go to the occipital. Sometimes they pass right through and go to the occipital lobe. So these are the nerves that go all the way through the occipital lobe. Okay, these two kinds of cells, the rod and cone cells, have two different functions, and they're in two different places in the retina, typically speaking. The rods are bigger than the cones, but we don't see that on this diagram. It looks like the cones are actually bigger. They're actually smaller cells. The rods are big. They're very sensitive to light. So you can see in very dim light conditions with the rod cells. But the kind of transducer they have is that you can only see in black and white or gray. You can't see color vision with rod cells. With the cones, you can see color. And since they're smaller, it gives you better visual acuity. You can see finer detail with the cones. So color vision and fine detail with cones. But the trade-off is that you need bright light. So if light is dim, you can't see color. Like if you're ever out on a dimly lit moonlit night, just a little bit of a moon shining, you probably don't see any colors whatsoever. Okay. But during the day, with bright sunlight, you can see a lot of colors. And that's because of the cone cells. The other difference is that these cone cells are in a part of your eye that we call the macula lutea. And that's right at the posterior pole of the eye. So let me see. I don't have a picture of that. Okay. But the macula lutea is going to be, if we look at the emmetropia condition right here, the macula lutea is going to be right smack in the posterior pole of the eye, so that when light comes straight in, it goes back and it falls on cone cells primarily. And the very central part of the macula lutea is called the fovea centralis. Fovea means a little pit in the retina, and it's the very center. It's populated with 100% cone cells. So it gives you the best acuity, the best color vision right here. And as we move away from the macula lutea, the cone cells decrease in number and rod cells increase in number. So rod cells are important in your peripheral vision. So in your peripheral vision, okay, you can sense very dim light, but only in black and white. And as you look around, you probably don't notice right now that you see things black and white in your peripheral vision, because we hardly ever concentrate on anything in our peripheral vision. So we just don't even recognize that. But we could make a little diagram. We could put a color line on the board, maybe on the whiteboard, and then all of a sudden we'll see that the color nature of that line disappears as it moves out away from our central vision. Okay. All right, so notice that these rod and cone cells are the farthest away of all these neurons from light as they enter the eye, because they make up the deepest layer within the retina, which is kind of strange. I would have guessed that the rod and cone cells were on the most superficial, okay, region where they'd be most sensitive to light, but light actually passes right through all these neurons right here. Okay, so the rods and cones send sensory information to the bipolar cells. The bipolar cells send electrical activity to the ganglion cells, and then the ganglion cells project those signals in the form of action potentials to the brain. The horizontal cells and the amacrine cells, right? The horizontal cells, this little guy here, and these amacrine cells right here, are important for processing information before it even gets to the brain. And we're not going to talk much about processing of optical information, because it's pretty complicated. And one thing, okay, that I can show you is that, all right, so here are a bunch of fibers, all right, that have to exit the eye. So they're going over what the most superficial layer of the retina, and they're all going to converge at one spot and leave the eye. And where they leave the eye, right, is a big thick nerve, and when there's a big thick nerve leaving the eye, you can't have any photoreceptor cells in that region. That's what we call the optic disc. And in that region of the optic disc, you have no rods and cones, and you have a blind spot. So the optic disc produces a blind spot. And did you guys see your blind spot in lab when you did sensory? No, not really? Okay, well, we got to do that. I'll show you how to find your blind spot. So in each eye, you have a blind spot. So I'll put a little exercise on the board, and I'll put two dots on the board, and if you close one eye and focus on one dot and move your head just in the right spot, all right, that other dot is, or my fingertip that points to the dot, it will just disappear. And that just tells you of the processing power of your brain and those and the amacrans, and you're probably looking for that blind spot right now, but you've been looking at that blind spot your whole life, and your brain has figured out how to fill it in with missing information. So there's just no way you can see it without using a little trick to reveal it, right? So it's not magic or anything. It's just our brain has figured out how to erase that blind spot from our perception. Another good example of how important processing of information is, and I would like to do this in lab sometime, but people get sick when we do it, so I don't like to do it. We can bring some glasses in that flip the world upside down. They invert the image. So you put the glasses on, and what's up there? That would be the floor. Okay. And what's down there? That's the ceiling, yeah, or the sky if you're outside. So if you put the inverting glasses on, everything that's up is down, and everything down that is up. That sounds like Al Gore or something. But after about a half hour, your brain flips the image so that the floor is down below you and that the ceiling is above your head, even though you're wearing the upside down glasses. But during that time, you're very disoriented, and sometimes people get really nauseated when their world is upside down. So your brain has just automatically flipped it. Now here's something that's even stranger. If you take your glasses off, guess how everything looks? Even though you're not wearing any glasses, it looks upside down once again. So now the floor is up there and the ceiling is down there for about 2 or 3 minutes, and then your brain flips it to where it should be. And so it's kind of an interesting experience, but it does, you know, make you feel real queasy when all that stuff happens. Okay, so the world might not always be as you see it. It's kind of how you've experienced reality before. It's from your previous experiences. Okay, let's talk about rod and cone cells. They have a couple of parts to them. They have an inner segment and an outer segment. The outer segment contains stacks of discs that contain photopigments. So what the heck is a photopigment? What's a pigment? What's a pigment? It is something that absorbs light energy. Is a pigment. Okay, and as a matter of fact, let's go back to that rainbow or visible light spectrum. Where's that at? Right here. All right, so here is the Roy G. Biv. I guess it's going back over in this direction because that looks sort of red to me. This looks more blue or violet indigo right over here. Okay, so these are all the colors that you can see. And a pigment is just a chemical that's going to absorb maybe one color or two or three colors. So for instance, if we take a chemical that can absorb red and yellow, or it can absorb that energy, what is that going to look like to your eye? So if we put it in sunlight, all of this light is going to be shining on that object, and that object, because it has those pigments, are going to absorb red and yellow. And here's green, not the green, but the red and yellow. So what color is that object going to look like to you? Okay. Well, because it's absorbing all the red and yellow, you can't see that. You'll see everything else that's left over because it's going to be reflected into your eyes. So it's going to look more like in this blue region right here, or violet, right? So if you have a green pigment, that object is going to look by combining these colors over here and these colors over here. I don't know what color that is, right? But Plants have a pigment that absorbs energy. What color do plants look like? They look green. So what colors does a plant absorb, and what color does a plant reflect? Okay. So the plant looks green. Is that green right there? Okay. Yeah, because I know my Roy G. Biv Jib is G is right in the middle. Okay. So both plants look green because the pigments aren't absorbing the green light. They absorb what? Almost everything else. The red and yellow and the blue, indigo, and violet. And it uses that energy to make sugar, to make glucose. All right, so that's why plants look green, because they're reflecting this color while absorbing every other color for their energy. All right. So these cells right here have pigments, photopigments. They absorb light energy. And the photopigments are down in the outer segment contained within these discs. And let's just talk about the rod cell over here. What kind of vision does a rod cell give you? Black and white or color? Black and white. Okay. The photopigment in rod cells for black-white vision is called rhodopsin. And maybe you've heard of rhodopsin. And it's composed of two chemicals. One is called opsin, and the other is called retinol. Retinol and opsin come together to form a pigment called rhodopsin. Okay. I think it's important probably for you to read through this slide right here, but that's not what I'm talking about at the moment. All right, so this is what rhodopsin looks like. It's part chemical, which we call opsin, and part retinol, and they fit together when retinol is in a cis conformation. That means it has a little bend to it. When it has this little bend, it fits right in something that almost looks like an active site on the opsin molecule. All right, but since it's a pigment, what can this molecule do? It can absorb light, and light is just energy. So when something absorbs light, sometimes it's like poking you in the side. Okay, so you're going to change conformation. And so retinol changes conformation from a cis conformation to what we call a trans conformation, and it straightens out. And now, since it has changed its shape, it doesn't fit in this compartment, which you could almost consider like the active site of opsin right here. Doesn't fit in, right? And it dissociates. But in order to dissociate from opsin, it has to absorb some light. This reaction we call a bleaching reaction. And once this rhodopsin has absorbed light, it can't absorb another photon of light until it re-associates again. And it takes some time to do that. And so you might have noticed that your retinas have been bleached at one point in time. When have you lost the ability to see after some bright light has been flashed in your eyes? Like when would be a good example? Oh, if it's light outside and dark inside? Sure, that happens to me, even though, yeah, I've got to take my glasses off because they're photo gray sometimes, right? But if you walk in a building and it's dark inside the building after being outside in bright sunlight, sometimes it takes you a little while to adjust. But even more startling is what? When somebody takes a picture of you and the flash goes off, right? And you see that white spot in front of your eyes, that flash that persists for a while because of that bleaching reaction. The opsin and retinol have to reassociate. Right. Okay. Well, anyway, the bleaching reaction causes changes in permeability of the rod cells, resulting in action potentials in the ganglion cells. The ganglion cells were what? That last cell that goes all the way to the brain. All right. The ganglion and amacrine cells produce action potentials. The rods, bipolars, and horizontal cells just produce graded potentials. There's no action potentials, but those ganglion cells produce action potentials. Visual transduction, okay, which means what? It's the conversion of light energy, electromagnetic radiation, into what form of energy does your brain talk to itself in? Action potentials, right? So visual transduction means changing light energy into action potentials, which means something to your occipital lobe. It is the inverse of other sensory systems. So we learned that when you stimulate a cell, right, is that usually caused by an EPSP or an IPSP? when you stimulate. Yeah, when you stimulate a cell. That's an EPSP, right? Okay, excitatory postsynaptic potential. And so how do you produce an EPSP? Do you hyperpolarize or depolarize a cell? By typically depolarizing a cell. How do you depolarize a cell? You take sodium, let it go inside, that depolarizes the cell, gets the threshold, and then you have an action potential. That's typically how we understand things to be stimulated, but the visual system doesn't work that way. It kind of works on an opposite kind of principle, which is kind of strange, and so it's fun to talk about. In the dark, photoreceptors release inhibitory neurotransmitter. And so the photoreceptors are what? The rod cells and cone cells in particular. So they're being excited into releasing a neurotransmitter. But that neurotransmitter is inhibitory. Just kind of put that in the back of your mind. All right, that hyperpolarizes the bipolar cells. That means that it produces iPSPs on the bipolar cells. Light inhibits the photoreceptors from releasing the neurotransmitter, thus stimulating the bipolar cells. All right, I'm going to have to show you a couple of diagrams so that you can appreciate what all these words mean. Okay, but let me give you a few more words. Rod and cones contain many sodium channels that are open in the dark. So in the dark, what's happening to the rods and cone cells? If the sodium channels? Yeah, so in the absence of stimulus, which is light, the rods and cones are depolarizing, which is really the opposite way that you have come to understand receptor cells. They depolarize when the stimulus is applied to them normally, not when the stimulus is withdrawn. So this depolarizing sodium flux is what we call the dark current. Light, on the other hand, hyperpolarizes by closing the sodium channels. So when the stimulus is applied, the sodium channels close, and that inhibits the rod and cone cells. All right, let's see how this system works. So here we have a disc in the outer segment of a rod cell, and let me move the screen just a little bit. Here is the plasma membrane of the outer segment of that cell, and here is a disc inside. And embedded in the disc we have, so this is rhodopsin, we have the retinol molecule. And in this particular, it's not drawn very well, but this is the cis conformation that fits just perfectly within the disc. And this molecule now is ready to absorb light energy. Also in the disc membrane we have G proteins. And what can G proteins do? They can become activated, dissociate, wander around in the membrane or maybe within the cell someplace. All right, so what other components do we have? We have a sodium channel right here. And in the dark, this sodium channel is open. So if it's open, sodium is doing what? It's going in, depolarizing the cell, stimulating the rod cell. And the reason why it's open is because in the dark, there is a compound called cyclic GMP. Cyclic GMP is very similar to cyclic AMP. You could consider this like a second messenger. Cyclic GMP comes from guanosine triphosphate, right? And when cyclic GMP is high inside the rod cell, it binds to the sodium channel, causes a conformation to keep it open. Also inside the outer segment of the cell is an enzyme called phosphodiesterase. It's always in the rod cell in pretty high concentration, right? But it is inactive. How can we activate or inactivate an enzyme? What's the one really good way to do that? By putting a phosphate molecule on it or taking a phosphate molecule off. Those are big molecules that change conformation of the whole protein. Either with a phosphatase takes it off or a kinase puts it on, right? And a phosphodiesterase, so let's get back to the activity of a phosphodiesterase. What phosphodiesterase does is that it converts cyclic GMP into just regular old GMP, not the cyclic form. All right? So typically in the dark, this phosphodiesterase is inactive. And so cyclic GMP builds up in the cell, binds to these ligand-gated channels, and it depolarizes the cell. Now let's consider what happens when light shines on this cell. It's picked up by the pigment. It converts cis retinol into all trans retinol. It dissociates from the opsin because it doesn't have the right shape anymore. And when that happens, that causes a perturbation in this G protein so that it dissociates. And the alpha subunit starts floating around in the outer component, outer segment of the cell, and it bumps into a phosphodiesterase and it activates it. And when that phosphodiesterase becomes active, right, it starts to convert cyclic GMP into regular old GMP, and now you don't have cyclic GMP to bind to this ligand-gated channel, so it changes conformation. What does it do? It closes. And when it closes, sodium can't get in, and the cell now hyperpolarizes, or it stops depolarizing. And that will persist, right, until this alpha subunit goes back, and this pigment here becomes unbleached. And that could take a long time. Hi, you found my note on the door? No? You just heard me. Okay. And so that reverses the effects of this light right here. All right, well, here's another good slide. I don't think the previous one was an exam figure, but this is an exam figure. So this one you have to know pretty well. So what kind of cell does this look like here, where the cursor is? That's a rod cell, right? And in the dark, right, there's plenty of cyclic GMP inside the outer segment, so it can bind to this sodium channel. And what does it do? It opens it up, so sodium can enter. Right? It's kept open because of cyclic GMP. So this cell is depolarizing, which is what? Stimulating this cell to release neurotransmitter on these bipolar cells. All right? So these potassium channels pretty much are open all the time, but in the dark, this sodium channel wins out. So it depolarizes the cell more than this potassium channel hyperpolarizes it. So you have more sodium channels open than you have potassium channels that are open. But of course, you always have the sodium-potassium ATP pump trying to maintain equilibrium inside the cell. Okay, so the rod cell is releasing neurotransmitter. Now, how come that doesn't produce a visual image? How come that doesn't result in action potentials going to the brain? Because this neurotransmitter right here is not stimulatory on the bipolar cell. It's an inhibitory neurotransmitter. So this neurotransmitter hyperpolarizes the bipolar cell, and when the bipolar cell is hyperpolarized, it doesn't release neurotransmitter, and the ganglion cell now does not depolarize, so action potentials aren't transmitted via the ganglion cell as a result of what? The release of this inhibitory neurotransmitter. All right, we can come back and take a look at that in a little bit, but let's talk about what's going to happen in the light condition when light shines on this photoreceptor cell. All right, so when light comes in, okay, that is that causes a conformation in the cis-retinol to trans-retinol that dissociates from the opsin. The G protein now dissociates, and what was the alpha unit goes, activates the phosphodiesterase. So since the phosphodiesterase is now activated, cyclic GMP is converted into a regular GMP. Cyclic GMP decreases in the cell, so this sodium channel closes. All right, so now the rod cell is no longer being depolarized because of that sodium current. All right, potassium is still leaving, so actually this cell hyperpolarizes very quickly because because we're closing the sodium channel and potassium is still leaking out. And when the rod cell hyperpolarizes, what happens to the release of neurotransmitter? It stops, right? Because now we're inhibiting this cell because of that light. But don't forget, that's an inhibitory neurotransmitter. So if we take away that inhibition on the bipolar cell, what does a bipolar cell do now? It depolarizes, probably because it has some sodium channels or something in it. It releases excitatory neurotransmitter on the ganglion cells. That produces action potentials that go to the occipital lobe to give you the perception of what? This light beam that hit this particular cell right here. So it's kind of a strange system, but it's really beautiful the way it operates. Okay, on a couple negative principles compared to what you're used to. And so be sure you know what that dark current is. And make sure you know something about that phosphodiesterase and cyclic GMP and the photoreceptor pigment in rod cells. We're not going to talk about the photopigments in cone cells, but there are three different kinds. We see three different colors of light with three different kinds of cone cells. So we have three primary colors that are all blended together to allow us to see probably millions of different kinds of colors, all based on the different mixture of those three primary colors. Okay. All right, so who's got a question? You might have to think about it over Wednesday and ask me Thursday. But definitely look at this figure right here. And as a matter of fact, if you're done with, you got to go vote tonight. Okay, never mind. But you could ask, those of you that don't have to vote, you could ask Ogoshi to go over it one more time with you if you haven't gone over this already in lab. I don't know if you went over this stuff already in lab. You did. Fantastic. Okay, well, you let me talk a really long time.
Well, not that
much. Oh, okay. Okay. Oh, okay, okay. Yeah. All right. Okay. Yeah, so take a look at that stuff. All right, so visual acuity versus sensitivity. In the fovea centralis, well, the fovea centralis is that pit that only has cone cells right in the center of the macula lutea. And the macula lutea gives you your best vision, your central vision. So when you look at something, your extrinsic eye muscles position your eye so that light shines where? Right smack in the middle of the macula lutea. That gives you your best vision. All right, so that's the job of those extrinsic eye. Can you picture what those extrinsic eye muscles look like from anatomy? You have superior rectus, inferior rectus, medial and lateral rectus, a couple oblique that turn your eyeball around when you're looking at stuff. Okay. Has anyone heard of a pathology associated with the macula lutea? I don't know. That's not ringing a bell for me. Say it again. Oh, a pathology of the macula lutea that gives a person visual deficits. Have you ever heard of macular degeneration? Probably, no? Macular degeneration? That's a degeneration of the macula lutea, which provides what? Your best vision, your most sensitive vision. It's a part of the vision that we rely on most, right in the very center of your visual field. So somebody with macular degeneration, that's the part of their visual field that disappears. It gets all fuzzy, or maybe it gets all black and mottled looking. So when they look at something, how do they have to look at it? They got to look at it from the side, because those are the only cells that can send information to their brain. So it's really kind of sad and unfortunate, because those people are losing what? Their best vision, and also their color vision as well. Okay. So here we have a slide that shows a couple cone cells over here and a couple rod cells over here. So this would be an example of maybe the fovea centralis or someplace in the macula lutea, where you have nice color vision and high acuity. And this is going to be more in your peripheral vision, which is going to be more sensitive, but you can only see in black and white. And that's due to the degree of convergence of signals. Okay, in your peripheral vision, notice here you have one ganglion cell, and it can be stimulated by what? We see in this particular example, five different kinds of rod cells. So if light hits anywhere in this area right here, it's going to send one signal to the brain saying that this big area right here has received one photon. But the brain can't tell if the photon hit the retina here, or here, or way over here. It all looks the same. So you have what? Very coarse spatial discrimination. You don't have very fine resolution in your vision. You can't really tell where light is coming from. It's very coarse. All right. But if light shines on any of these, right, then it's going to cause an action potential going to the brain. So this area right here is very sensitive to very dim light, because there are so many photoreceptor cells, it's just going to average the light intensity over a big surface area. As opposed to, for instance, the fovea centralis, where every single photoreceptor cell is connected up to a single ganglion cell. All right, so in this particular case, your occipital lobe can tell if light was shined on this cell, or the neighboring cell, or even the other neighboring cell. So you have much better resolution. You can tell exactly where that light hit the retina, because there is no convergence whatsoever. Okay, but in this particular case, because there's no convergence, you need very bright light to stimulate this cone cell. Okay, so you could think of this as like a two-point discrimination, right? If you took, if these were pressure receptors instead of light receptors, if we took a pin or two pins, right, and we poked one here and we poked one here, what would it feel like to your brain if we poked one here and one here? Because there's only one axon going to the brain, right? It wouldn't matter if you poked a pin here or here, it would feel like the same stimulus. But in this case, since every cone cell has its own ganglion cell, if we poked even closer together, here and here, you could tell that there were two pins. Right? So, but instead of pins, actually think of photons of light striking these two different cells. Right? So this, with no convergence, you decrease sensitivity, but you increase resolution, the ability to see something very close together. And I think, is this the last slide? Yeah, last slide. Okay, eye movements. Remember, it's the superior colliculus that coordinates your eyes, that allows you to track on objects that are moving in space. Oh, wow, I got to stop after this. All right, last slide. Where's Dr. Oghoshi? Oh, I thought he was going to kick me out of here. This is it right here. All right, so remember, we're talking about the corpora quadrigemina, and it's the superior colliculus that allows your eyes to fixate on an object, and if the object's moving, to track that object in space, if it's curving or moving across your visual field. But also the superior colliculus, if nothing's moving, okay, and you want to look at something, your eye doesn't just sweep across the room in a nice continuous fashion. It actually jumps from one object to another, to another, to another, to another, while your brain recognizes that object, and then it moves to another object. We call that saccadic movement. Or when your eye jumps from one object to another, we call that a saccade, that, or a jumping motion, and that's due to the superior colliculus. So your eye moves by what we call ballistic motion, right? It moves, it hops from one object to another. And that's important even with a fixed gaze, okay? There are tiny, what we call fixational movements. Because when you're, hey, I'll be done in just a couple minutes. Yeah, but you can come in. Yeah? Okay. So fixational movements. So if you're going to look at an object for a long period of time, what's going to happen to the rhodopsin in your eye when all that light is coming in? The rhodopsin is going to bleach, right? And when it bleaches, it can't receive any more information. It can't send action potentials to the brain. So how do you prevent that bleaching, of that burning in of that image into the retina? What your eye does is that it moves a little bit all the time. Those are what we call fixational movements, so that the bleaching reaction occurs in different parts of your retina so that you continue to have a visual field. Okay, so that's what we call a fixational movement. So that prevents photoreceptor bleaching. And then, of course, the superior colliculus is also important for the pupillary reflex, which constricts the pupil when there's bright light and dilates the pupil when there's dim light. And the pupil is not you guys, it's what? That's that space in the retina. No, the space in the iris, okay, in response to strong light. So pupillary reflex is partly controlled by the parasympathetic nervous system, partly sympathetic nervous system. Which one does which? Sympathetic nervous system does what to the pupil? I don't know if it slows it down. It's either dilate or constrict. Dilate. Sympathetic dilates, parasympathetic constricts, and you should be able to relate that to the circular or the radial fibers in the iris. Okay. Okay. So we didn't get very far today, but anyway. So we're going to start with chapter 11 next time. So I'll turn my microphone off. Look, you got a question, real quick question? No? Okay. Parasympathetic for constriction, sympathetic for dilation, pupil dilation.